You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
Let me state clearly that we do not expect anyone to guard our borders for us. That can and should only be done by Europeans. But we expect a major step towards changing the rules of the game when it comes to stemming the migration flow that is coming to the EU via Turkey.
The European Council President Donald Tusk there as the EU and Turkey reach a deal on the ongoing refugee crisis. Nina Schick and Jane Kinnamont will tell us their thoughts on this and the day's other top stories, including Germany is set to approve the deployment of 1,200 soldiers to the anti-IS conflict in Syria. But what does this say about Germany's willingness to play a role in the fight, and will it open a new chapter for military across the continent? Also ahead...
We will not involve the European Union in what is happening here in terms of the peace process until we understand exactly what are their choices and what is their policy.
Israel suspends the EU from peace talks with Palestine, but does it actually change anything? And finally on tonight's programme, we ask if the glory days of being a host city for the Olympics are over, as Hamburg's residents reject the city's bid for the 2024 Games. That's all to come right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Hey, warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Nina Schick and Jane Kinnamont. Nina Schick is the Director of Communications at the EU policy think tank Open Europe, and Jane's the Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. So welcome both back to Midori House. Great to have you with us as always. Let's start today's programme by having a look at Turkey. It seems that Brussels and Ankara have struck a deal on how to try and manage the ongoing refugee crisis. In return for some cash, around 3 billion euros to be precise, Turkey's promised to help stem the flow of migrants into Europe. But it's not only money on the EU's side of the table. Visas and renewed talks on Turkey's membership of the EU are also part of the deal. Leaders have called this a new beginning, fairly optimistically. But is it really? Nina, perhaps I'll start with you. I guess that's a good question. A new beginning or a false dawn?
Well, I think that the Turkish side knows in these talks that the EU is very, very desperate. And Turkey has now become like the linchpin in how to deal with the migration crisis. So Erdogan struck a hard bargain. It's very interesting to hear what Merkel said only a few weeks ago before... You know, the refugee crisis has hit the heights that it's reached now. She went on public TV in Germany and said she's against Turkey's accession to the EU and always has been and still is. So the fact is that this is very much a carrot for Turkey. But if it is ever to join the EU, let's not forget that all EU member states have a veto over those talks. So Cyprus and Greece, unlikely to sign up to this. So... Again, this is very much a sign of the EU trying to find means in which to quell the flow of people into Europe. And the money is quite significant. Turkey wanted more, and I think that's still open for talks. But if Turkey is able to get visa-free travel into the Schengen area, that, of course, is tremendous. But they have to fulfill some certain conditions before that's a certainty.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about some of the sort of rows around accession or otherwise. But I guess, Jane, a lot of people say, well, hang on, this is pure old-fashioned hypocrisy on the part of the EU. You know, it's offering support to Turkey now because it directly wants something in return. Is that a crass oversimplification, or do you think that there's an element of truth to that?
Well, I'll give you one of the arguments for this. Turkey so far has taken a disproportionately low proportion of the Syrian refugees when you look at the size of the population. They've taken a similar number to Jordan. Jordan has 6.5 million people. Turkey has 75. So Jordan and Lebanon are unable, really, demographically to accommodate more Syrian refugees. If you're looking for ways to give refugees options closer to home, which is where many refugees do actually want to be, then it does make sense to give Turkey incentives for more. But of course, there's also concerns about what unspoken incentives there are, whether this basically means a free pass when it comes to the growing authoritarian tendencies of the Turkish government. And so you have seen some of the Turkish opposition parties be themselves very critical of the deal.
Well, yeah, and I think that's the sort of elephant in the room, isn't it, Nina? Look at some of those issues Jane's talking about there, you know, freedom of speech or lack of it, general lack of democracy. What do you think the answer to that is? Why is the EU willing to seemingly kind of overlook those concerns?
Well, I mean,
is it just political expediency, I guess, is the question?
I think it is political expediency because the EU does not have a choice in this matter. If you look at what's happened in the past few months, we have never seen divisions this deep running through the EU. It threatens the entire project. And the one leader in Europe who's always been seen as steady and strong, Merkel herself, she's in danger of losing power. Today, there was a poll that came out in Germany that says 44% of Germans think she shouldn't run for chancellor again. Only a few months ago, her approval ratings were at 73%. Mm. So it very much is about political expediency. If you also think about how many far-right and anti-immigration parties are rising across Europe, you know, these guys that make UKIP look like teddy bears. If the EU is to, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that this migration crisis has threatened the EU in a way that we haven't seen before. And political leaders would be wise to find means such as working with the origin and transit countries to try and relieve some of the pressures that we've seen in the past few months so that they can start having an honest debate with the public and show that they're in control of the situation.
Jane, I wonder, when it comes to some of the questions around Turkish accession, do you think that it's legitimate to say, well, hang on, you know, if we'd involve Turkey more positively before, you go back to the big raft of sort of incoming nations, 10 or 11 years ago now, you know, should we not have set up a more constructive dialogue with the Turks at that point? Maybe we would have been able to get, you know, more progress with them on things like democracy and press freedom. And in a way, some within the EU project are possibly reaping what they sow in that respect.
There was a missed opportunity. Turkey's leaders realised that the EU was not serious about accession talks. They began focusing much more on their relations and trade outreach to the Middle East, and it probably gave the EU less leverage than it might have had when it came to issues like the jailing of journalists and so forth. The problem is that part of the reason that we see all these anti-immigration parties in Europe doing well is that Western European countries still haven't come to terms with that big eastward expansion in 2004. I'm extremely sceptical that any of the European governments are really very serious about seeing Turkish accession as really being on the cards. I suspect that it's rather something that they can offer Erdogan, which will help him to look better in his home country, where he's obviously recently won elections again, but he still faces a pretty strong opposition.
And what about that note about Schengen expansion or you know, flexibility to it, maybe allowing Turkey to join in? You mentioned it would be a massive step forward. In a way, the Schengen zone has never been questioned in quite the way it's being questioned right now in the aftermath, of course, of events in Paris. Doesn't even the prospect of that or the discussion of it complicate something that's already very complex yet further?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, realistically, I can't see Turkey joining Schengen. I think for Turkey to be given visa-free travel into the Schengen zone, that would be a massive step, because I think the public in Europe would be so against it, because they would feel that, okay, now you are having millions more people travel within this border-free area. And that, as Paris has shown us, has proven to be very counterproductive. And the fact is that unless the EU can protect its external borders, then Schengen is very much under threat. And of course, we already have internal border controls now at Germany, Turkey, Sweden. But Schengen is extremely under threat, but they're saying that this is legal under the provisions of the Schengen agreement, which it is. But how long are we going to see these temporary border controls? That's the more important question.
Turkey itself is one of the main routes into Syria for the Europeans that do go into Syria. So there's a very big question about its policing of its own border.
Just looking at Erdogan, and Jen, you were sort of talking about this a moment ago, do you think there's still a bit of a problem here in that, not to broad brush it, but the EU or European leadership, they still can't quite work out who they're dealing with and what they're dealing with when it comes to Erdogan? Do you think that they feel they can trust him? Is there someone that they can work with positively? Or do you think there's still a bit of, I don't know, scepticism or cynicism about what he represents?
The biggest criticisms of Turkey probably have come around its its somewhat ambiguous views on the role of the jihadi groups in Syria. That's probably, frankly, the thing European governments are going to take more seriously. Of course, there are human rights issues, the peace process with the Kurds, which Erdogan really had pushed forward, has broken down. But unfortunately, I think just now many European leaders would frankly probably rather have Gaddafi back in Libya if he was going to take a supposedly tough stand against migrants and terrorism.
With that ambiguity that Jane describes there in terms of the view of Erdogan, is that sustainable? Can you have dialogues where there is that sort of ambiguity kind of in the room? Is it too, does it make it a complicated matter even more difficult to fathom?
I don't think they have a choice. They have to have that conversation. They need to have that conversation with Turkey, just as we're seeing they are now having the conversation with Putin after, you know, a year of trying to freeze him out over Ukraine. The fact is that we are seeing so much instability in Europe's neighbourhood that it wouldn't be sustainable for European politicians not to have these conversations with despots or tyrants or people who they think are not standing up to the ideals of Western democracy. It has to be done.
Let's move on from this one new friendship to another. It seems Germany's joined the group of Western nations deploying military to Syria as part of the efforts of the anti-Islamic State campaign. Around 1,200 soldiers would be operating planes and ships, and while the military has stressed there would be mainly reconnaissance missions, if approved, it would nevertheless be Germany's biggest military operation overseas. Jane, do you think this plan will go ahead, and will go ahead as it's outlined from what we understand at this point?
Yes, I think it's the beginning of quite a serious change. You know, Germany has been a country that hasn't traditionally been involved in these kinds of intervention. It doesn't have a colonial past in the Middle East. They have vaunted the fact that they were part of the Iran nuclear deal to show that they have diplomatic credentials in the region, but their foreign minister and others are also adamant that diplomacy needs some kind of force to back it up with, and that you can't have soft power without a degree of hard. What might be tricky is looking at where the forces are going to be based. Turkey and Jordan have both been mooted, but Germany does also have a large Kurdish lobby at home. In some ways, Jordan might be the easier option.
Nina, what do you make of this in terms of, if we look at, you know, what it says about Germany's willingness to play a role, whatever it looks like, even if it involves the military? You know, we're not used to having that conversation. Can we read something into the bigger picture for Germany and what this represents?
Well, obviously, Germany has been a very pacifistic country in a recent history, for obvious reasons. And I'm half German, so it's interesting to see that there were polls recently after Paris, and I think that was really the changing point, where the majority of the population was saying they were in favour of the Bundeswehr stepping in and somehow fighting against IS. But it's still worth pointing out that this is a very small intervention when you look at it relatively. It's only 1,200 troops, it's one ship and a few Tornado jets for reconnaissance and air refueling, etc. Nonetheless, I think we have seen Germany becoming much more active, perhaps reluctantly, when it comes to foreign policy. Even before this happened in Paris, you know, with Ukraine, Germany was a key leading broker in striking a peace deal there, even though, well, the ceasefire, the unrespected ceasefire. And recently, they've also sent troops to Mali. And this is an interesting intervention. It's definitely not insignificant. It will be their second largest intervention after the troops that they deployed in Afghanistan and Uzbekistan. So, yeah, it's significant.
And what's the view, I was going to say at home, but within Germany, is there a comfort level now with troops being deployed where it's part of a multilateral force? It makes the decision easier. I mean, is that the sort of national view, if we can characterise it
Absolutely.
That way?
I think it's essential for the Germans that it's, you know, they're part of a NATO force or they're part of a Western coalition. It's not just German troops going in. And as I understand it, they will be very much in a support role, helping the French military, supporting the French military. And the interesting thing is that, as I said, I think Paris was the changing point, and the German constitution, it actually said the army can only be used when they need to defend the borders of Germany. But in recent times that interpretation has become looser and looser. So I think it's very important for the Germans to feel that this intervention is done on constitutional grounds and is in line with international law. So the Bundestag will have a debate on it and vote on it, but I expect it to be passed by the Bundestag.
And Jane, I mean, that's interesting. We've heard a lot of sceptical voices about, you know, suggesting the Germans wouldn't go even for this sort of involvement. Is it the question of, you know, events in Paris being the sea change? Is something else happened? I mean, some of those sceptical voices were still being heard even after Hollande's meeting with Merkel recently. I mean, has something else changed, or do you think we can trace it back to Paris and how that, you know, changed the landscape?
Well, there may be an issue of generational change here, as fewer people directly remember the Second World War and its aftermath. Let's not forget that in Japan now also we see a prime minister who's trying to test the limits of that pacifistic constitution that they have.
And I guess maybe finally, what do you think about what this means for other European players? You know, does it prompt, you know, will it prompt, could it prompt reviews politically in other countries? Or do you think that the die is cast now and we kind of know who the protagonists are going to be in this battle with IS? Events in Westminster, I guess, notwithstanding.
Well, I guess that the key European players when it comes to domestic foreign policy remain the UK and France. So it's very interesting to see that the UK in recent years, given what happened to Ukraine, took more of a back seat, having pushed so hard for economic sanctions on Russia. They weren't really involved in the Minsk agreement, and Germany and France took the lead there. But I think, again, on Syria, the lead, when it comes to the European players at least, it's going to be the UK and France.
And just to look back on Merkel, and you talked about the, you know, the changing sort of domestic picture for her, and we've been talking about how, you know, bullish that she had been previously and how well supported she was from in the public. Is this an issue in terms of whether we're talking about, you know, the migration question? It's obviously tied in so many ways to the IS thing and what's happening in Syria. Is that a make or break for her? I mean, do you think that is her position salvageable now? Do you think she can convince those 44% who are saying, look, we don't think that it's right for you to stick around, to change their view in terms of what she does politically from here on in?
I think it's very tricky for her. Merkel really has miscalculated, I think, just the sheer numbers of people that are coming to Germany and what it's going to cost Germany. Current estimates by the German government is that 1.5 million people will arrive by the end of the year. And when you have a society like Germany where they're just kind of becoming more comfortable with a multicultural society, I mean, it's not the same as London, it's not the same as France, because they don't have a, you know, colonial history in the same way. People have become very frightened. And it's interesting that the right-wing Alternative for Deutschland, which is a party that in the summer looked like it was decimated, is now polling, is the third largest party in the polls. It's polling on 10.5%. So whether or not Merkel can overcome this, I think, really depends on whether in the next few months she can persuade the public that she is in control of the situation. And if they feel that she isn't, I think for the first time, you really have Merkel in danger.
And Jane, just to pick up on, I mean, Nina mentioned the sort of some of the more nationalistic, you know, factions on the right in Germany. We've talked before about this phenomenon throughout Europe, that what we're seeing has provided, you know, grist to the mill. It's given people the ammunition with which to exploit, you know, populist messages and drive this sort of right-wing rhetoric forward. Do you think that the electorates in the sort of Western Europe are now savvy enough to unpick that, and they realise what's happening, and they can see that people are trying to manipulate a position of stress to make political capital themselves? Or do you worry that there's still, you know, more momentum maybe that some of these right-wing groups can still make despite people's understanding of the issue?
I do worry about it. I think when people are making decisions in conditions of fear and uncertainty, they can often make decisions that are more emotionally driven. I think it's quite important, for instance, that you have the police, as they have done in the UK, speaking out about how actually the Muslim community is at the forefront of the fight against terrorism, that so much of the intel that they get comes from Muslims, that much of the effective counter-propaganda also comes from the Muslim community, and that sort of demonising Muslims or migrants or any minority community is totally counterproductive.
That's Jane Kinnamont, Nina Schick still with us here, of course, on Midori House. Coming up next, Israel puts the European Union in a timeout, and Hamburg citizens say no.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio, every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are my guests of today, Nina Schick and Jane Kinnamont. Now, Israel has said it's suspending all contact with all European Union bodies involved in the peace talks with Palestinians following the EU's decision to start labelling all exports from Israeli settlements in the West Bank. These new guidelines stipulate that the settlements built on territories occupied by Israel in 1967 are illegal under international law and that all products then sold in EU member states must have clear labels showing the place of origin. Jane, perhaps I'll start with you. I imagine some people might say, I didn't really realise that the European Union was playing any kind of role in a peace process. And for that matter, what's the peace process looking like right now anyway? Is that just too cynical a viewpoint?
No, there is no peace process. There are no talks ever since John Kerry basically failed to knock various heads together and get something moving. And typically, European diplomats say we cannot do anything unless the US is engaged. The US won't be engaged until there's a new president. Previous experience suggests that once there is a new president, they'll say, well, the US won't do anything because he's in his first term, or she indeed is in her first term, and it will just go on and there will be a huge amount of buck passing. But the European Union is the largest donor to the Palestinian Authority. They have a huge amount of influence on the Palestinians, for instance, in capacity building for Palestinian security forces, something which the EU, something which Israel massively wants to continue. So Israel is signally not saying the EU is going to be cut out of providing the aid that keeps the Palestinian Authority running. They're using this kind of gesture politics to say, don't push us.
Nina, what do you think the response will be to some of the rhetoric we've seen from Israel today around this, given that it doesn't seem to materially affect a process which, as Jane probably quite rightly says, is in rather a state of, well, it's in stasis. What will the response be then, you know, within Brussels and the wider EU community?
I think this is just the culmination of long-term tensions between Israel and the EU, given the EU's critical position of Israel's resettlement policy. And this has happened in the past. You know, they've had bust-ups about this. But as Jane pointed out, the EU actually has a lot of investment in Israel. In fact, Israel's largest trading partner is the EU. They do $30 billion of trade with the EU each year. So the fact is that the more the EU becomes disillusioned, okay, in the short term, you can imagine they manage to somehow get beyond this. But the more the EU becomes disillusioned in the peace process and thinks that the resettlement policy means that a two-state solution is not viable, I suppose economically Israel could stand to lose.
I mean, given that economic, you know, power that the EU technically has, should more be being done? Or was Jane right in that the fact remains until we see what happens, you know, in Washington, D.C. and who's in the White House next year, it doesn't really make that much difference in real practical terms?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are different schools of thoughts on how successful, if you're suggesting economic sanctions actually are. And I don't think that alienating Israel with economic sanctions is necessarily the best policy, especially now when the Middle East is so fraught and you probably need them on side.
Jane, should we gear up to just see, I don't know, a kind of ongoing war of words then between these two parties, at least for now? And does it all depend on, you know, 2016 and the race for the White House?
I think the EU could do more. I think they basically...
What would it look like?
Beginning with some of their economic levers. For instance, the Dutch are investing in trying to facilitate Palestinian trade by beefing up the security capacity at the ports of Gaza, which doesn't address the whole of the problem, because there are also political issues that why Israel wants the economy of Gaza not to function, but not to function at a thriving level. But putting those technical things in place can at least help to remove some of the ostensible reasons for blockages. Another thing that some Palestinians have been calling for is finding ways to allow the Palestinian Authority to collect more of its own taxes and custom revenues under the Oslo Accords. Israel collects them and gives them to the Palestinian Authority. Israel often withholds it for political reasons. So that's another area where the Europeans might be able to work with the Palestinians to help them to have a little bit more fiscal independence, especially the Palestinian Authority, which of course has been the ones participating in peace talks when they were happening.
That's interesting. Do you think there are maybe voices within the EU, some of the EU countries, who believe that there are these other economic levers, as Jane describes them, short of sanctions, that maybe, you know, could be pulled or pressed to try and, you know, drive the process a little more positively?
Yes, certainly. And I think the EU has always been a little bit more critical than the US. And already after, you know, those John Kerry failed in his talks in 2014, and the ensuing crises that happened again, the EU was losing its patience, and it was no secret that European diplomats were considering sanctions, or at least, you know, thinking about them. But it's a tricky one, because in order to, for the EU to apply economic sanctions, you would need unanimous agreement amongst all EU 28. And as we see so often when it comes to the European Union, getting that is easier said than done.
Seems to be something of a theme of today's programme, in fact. Before we end, let's head to the wonderful world of the Olympics, or Olympic bids. Hosting such an international event used to be an honour for any city, but it seems now more and more cities are inclined to pass. The latest to do so has been Hamburg, after 52% of the population decided against continuing the city's bid for the 2024 Olympic Games in a citywide referendum. Opponents had argued hosting would cost the city too much in public funds, and also raised environmental and security concerns as well. Jane, has the Olympic Games, or hosting the Olympic Games, lost its luster for good, do you think?
Usually it's a one-off economic boom. Usually growth slows down the year after Olympic Games. So often countries go for it for prestige rather than clear economic benefits. But of course there are many countries, especially perhaps from the developing world, who are really, really keen to get these games because they can really propel themselves to the international spotlight in a way that perhaps Germany doesn't need to do.
Well, it's interesting, it's the second German city in 2 years, as I understand it, to say no. Why is that? Is it purely economic? Is it the point that maybe we need to gear up, that, you know, we're not going to see essentially democratic nations hosting this event anymore? It will be vanity projects and countries who can direct the resources in that way that Jane describes.
Yeah, I think it's several reasons. First, a good place to start is cost. I mean, the Sochi Winter Olympics in Russia cost $51 billion. So when it comes to developed Western countries, are they actually going to get much return on their investment? Probably not, because they already have high infrastructure and they have low levels of unemployment. So that boost that hosting those economies, the Olympics could give you, are probably not worth it. But then I also think the entire Olympic brand has become very tarnished. I mean, in the bidding for the 2022 Winter Olympics, we have those great moral democratic bastions of Kazakhstan and China, you know. So, and also if you think of all the scandals engulfing international sports, whether it's FIFA or now, you know, the doping things coming out with athletics, I think people, they just don't see the International Olympic Committee as particularly transparent, or, you know, they don't see it as such a, it's perhaps more of a PR exercise for the dictatorships.
Well, and perhaps that's the point, isn't it, Jane? I mean, do we just need to accept, as we alluded to already, that, you know, Western liberal democracies aren't going to host this event anymore? Maybe post whatever it is, Tokyo, it will only be, you know, sort of these autocratic regimes. It would be a shame for the Olympic movement. But, or do you think that actually Nina's right and it would be strangely fitting in some respects?
Well, I think you've seen the London Olympics, which was something very popular, which did manage to boost infrastructure in a particular area of East London, even if the legacy promises weren't fully implemented as they were meant to be. And I think maybe the Scottish National Party will also be seeking more Glasgow-based and Edinburgh-based events in the coming years. So, yes, Britain will still be interested.
Well, that's good to know. At least somebody can get involved. We're going to leave it there. Nina Schick and Jane Kinnamont, thanks very much for joining us here today on Midori House. House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producer, Carlotta Ribello, research team of Fernando Augusto Pacheco et al., and our studio manager, Kieran Banerjee. For the next half hour, stay tuned. Bill Luthi's playing his favourites from Monocle's international playlist, 1900 Culture with Robert Bound. And the Monocle Daily will have more on the stories we've been discussing and more 2200 London time. This show's back at 1800 tomorrow here on Monocle 24. But for this edition, the team here at Midori House, thanks very much for tuning in. Goodbye.